From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro. In 1961, John F. Kennedy characterized it as a sword of Damocles hanging over all of our heads, the threat of nuclear warfare, or an accident, or an act of madness. The film Countdown to Zero, playing in theaters now, reminds us the risk has not disappeared but grown worse. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. There are an estimated 23,000 nuclear weapons on the planet that we know about. A new film, Countdown to Zero, attempts to excite public interest in this threat. 65 years after the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, nuclear Armageddon seems like a fading chapter from the history books, not a clear and present threat to everybody on the planet. We're joined this morning by Lucy Walker, who wrote and directed the film. Lucy, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined by the producer, Academy Award winner Lawrence Bender, who has also produced An Inconvenient Truth. Thank you, Lawrence, for being here as well.
My pleasure.
Well, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the Cuban Missile Crisis, these events are fading from living memory. Most adults, but not all of us, remember the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Chernobyl disaster. But we all remember 9/11. Lawrence, why do you think nuclear Armageddon is not top of mind in the U.S. today?
Well, good question. I mean, it seems like it should be, but you're absolutely right, it's not. And I think because, you know, a lot of time has gone on. We're very focused as a country on, you know, things that seem to be happening right now today, and usually not the biggest, you know, global events, but things that are kind of, you know, whatever hits the sort of news media. But, you know, also if you're in college today, you're born after the Berlin Wall came down, and so it's not really part of your psyche in a sense. And as you mentioned, the events that you mentioned before seem like ancient history. So it's something that people, you know, at least during the Cold War, when Russia and the United States are poised with thousands and thousands of weapons that we can destroy each other, of course, it's on everyone's mind. But post-Cold War, that's not the issue. But yet the risk is actually even greater now, which is why we made the movie, to sort of wake, is a wake-up call. So, you know, this is not a time to sort of stop being vigilant.
Lucy Walker, you talked to a wide variety of statesmen, former statesmen. I'm thinking former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, ex-Soviet Premier Mikhail Gorbachev, former Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf. This is not a liberal versus conservative issue, it seems.
That's right. It's really a nonpartisan issue and a global issue. I think we had something crazy like 11 heads of state, which is, I think, more than any other movie. But we also had nuclear smugglers, nuclear physicists. We had all the experts from policy to science to the people who really had their finger on the button. And they're all coming to this quite surprising conclusion that moving forward, zero is really the only safe solution. That means eliminating nuclear weapons. President Obama called for a world without nuclear weapons. And that seems to be such a surprising conclusion if you remember the days of people marching against nuclear weapons back in the nuclear freeze movement in the 80s. I'm a little bit young for that, but my older sister was marching, for example. And those days, I think it felt like a very liberal issue. And these days, it's sort of surprising how many Republicans are on side. Gorbachev actually had some amazing recollections about meeting President Reagan at Reykjavik in 1986, and how President Reagan, for example, had wanted all-out disarmament. We also include President Kennedy in the movie with the speech he gave. So there's just all kinds of people that looking at the world today with terrorism and proliferation going the way that they're going, saying that even if you used to think that deterrence was useful, that these things were useful tools of statecraft, and there was this position of MAD, mutually assured destruction, it was called, you know, with the standoff with the Soviet Union and the U.S., these days, looking forward, we're in a whole new paradigm and a whole new world of trouble.
Well, that raises an interesting question, and I was thinking about that concept of mutually assured destruction while watching this film. There are a lot of not nice people running governments around the world, and even though terrorist groups are a big concern, it's fair to say that governments own most of the nuclear weapons we know about. Is there no place for that strategic concept anymore?
I think we're looking at a whole new paradigm because there's no technological bar to entry anymore. It used to be that you could have a safe arsenal, or you know, a few relatively well secured arsenals in the most technically advanced countries, and that had risks enough. I mean, we cataloged the most jaw dropping incidents imaginable in the movie with all these near misses and accidents and all kinds of hair raising craziness that people didn't know about. But moving forward, we've got in 9 countries now with nuclear weapons. Should we go through them? USA, Russia, China, UK, France, India, Pakistan, Israel, North Korea. Iran looks like it's going to be the 10th any minute now. And is that the tipping point, is what people are asking? Who might follow next? And the question, I suppose, that frightens me is that even if nobody intends to let a weapon off, and I think, unfortunately, there's a good chance that in future there will be wars, skirmishes, and so on where that's the case. Even if no one actually intentionally sets one off, the risk is never zero because of accidents, which is something sort of surprising that the movie looks at. And then you've also got the risk of the weapons getting to the wrong hands with terrorism, which the movie also looks at. So there's just a lot of different things to worry about. And in future, if more countries get weapons and they're potentially less well secured or in less stable countries, we're in just for a lot of potential problems. And the trouble with nuclear weapons is even one going off would have such catastrophically horrible consequences, because really one of these bombs can actually destroy a whole city that we're in, you know, that the risk, just because the results would be so horrible doesn't mean that something couldn't happen. And that's what's truly frightening about these weapons. The scale is just so hard to get one's brain around.
It is worth pointing out that as we sort of gradually move away from Hiroshima, from Nagasaki, that it's as if people sort of forget what it means for an entire city to be incinerated, or a good 5 miles worth of people and buildings, but mostly people I'm thinking of. You have a number of clips from Robert Oppenheimer, the UC Berkeley professor who led the Manhattan Project that birthed the atom bomb. And I was particularly taken with a clip really in which he tears up talking about a famous quote he was thinking about when the first atom bomb was detonated in New Mexico. Oppenheimer says he thought of a line by the Hindu god Vishnu in the Bhagavad Gita.
He knew the world would not be the same. Two people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty. And to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
It's a profoundly moving moment. This is a nuclear physicist who's not typically given to tears in a public forum. Lawrence Bender,
it's one of those amazing moments in the movie. He's got such a haunting face, and he was asked, by the way, at one point we talk about it in the movie. He's asked, "How can you stop a terrorist from getting, or someone from smuggling a nuclear weapon into the country. This is many, many years ago, and he says with a screwdriver to open up every single container that enters the country. And that was when we were, you know, so how prescient was he at that point? And he was such a haunted man by being basically known as the father of the weapon that could basically destroy the world. It's just, it's a beautiful, beautiful moment.
You know, the vast majority of nuclear missiles are owned not by terrorists, by the U.S. and Russia, something on the order of 95-96%. Lawrence Bender, why do you think we have so many weapons still pointed at each other on hair trigger alert?
Well, it's a good question. The thing is, at the height of the Cold War, there was almost 70,000 nuclear weapons, almost all of them owned by us and and Russia. Now, the good news is that the nuclear freeze movement, as Lucy mentioned, did have a huge effect, and we've come down to something like 23,000. So that was there was a big effect, and we had a great, great reduction. But we still have each enough nuclear weapons to destroy the world many, many times over. And there's still a couple thousand on it's called hair trigger alert. Basically, within 2 minutes, one of these nuclear weapons can still be launched and aimed directly at each other. So that's a good question. Now, I think it's a little bit a matter of momentum and a little bit of there's still the nuclear Neanderthals that are still there. But basically, there's been a lot of good and very positive movement. As you know, the new START Treaty was signed by both Presidents Medvedev from Russia and our president. And, you know, let's not forget that the whole START Treaty process of reduction was started by our great liberal president, Ronald Reagan. And he had several beautiful speeches, one of which is in the movie, about his dream about the complete elimination of nuclear weapons from the face of the earth. So as you mentioned earlier, this is not a partisan issue. And so the new START Treaty has a modest reduction. And hopefully that will be ratified by both the Senates of our country and Russia. And then the next step will occur. Well, there will be talk about new reductions. And it is, as you say, because we have so many of the nuclear weapons in our countries, it's really important that we and Russia together take the lead in this sort of downward pressure to eliminate or at least start to reduce the nuclear weapons that we both have. It reduces the risk of accidents, as Lucy mentioned. And two, as the United States and Russia start to lower our nuclear weapon arsenals, lower and lower and lower, countries like China will then start to hopefully get into it, and then India. And the global zero sort of movement, there's a wonderful plan that was created by about 25 politicians and military commanders that's backed by hundreds of former heads of states and military commanders. And it does start with the United States and Russia reducing, and then the rest of the world getting into this multilateral negotiation to downwardly reduce in a proportionate, verified, monitored way. It's only in that way that we'll be able to start to get rid of these things. The other thing, if I could just mention really quickly, is that some people listening might know that a couple of months ago, the president had a nuclear summit in D.C. He had 47 heads of states, the most heads of countries from around the world in D.C. since the creation of the United Nations, for one purpose, that is to get lock up and secure all the nuclear materials around the world, so that's the stuff that, you know, you stick in bombs and everything blows up, and that's the stuff that we're very scared that terrorists can get their hands on. And so if we can lock that stuff up, then we can secure the world from that point of view. And so he had a very successful meeting with all these people then. So we are heading in the right direction.
Lucy Walker, following along those lines, it's been a few years since the Soviet Union collapsed, and your film Countdown to Zero reminds us that most of the loose fissile material popping up in black markets comes from former Soviet republics. Couldn't somebody have taken out a checkbook and come up with some palatable way to put all that uranium under lock and key years ago?
You know, there are wonderful efforts going on, and I was embedded with some amazing agents from the National Nuclear Security Agency on missions to secure this material. The trouble is there's a lot of it, and it's quite challenging to move it because that incurs new risks. The good news is there are programs that are working on it, and the bad news is that clearly some material was taken by the wrong people. I sat down with a nuclear smuggler in Tbilisi, Georgia, who was fortunately in jail now, but he had sold real deal bomb grade uranium, the ingredient you can make the most easy kind of bomb with. And he had smuggled this from Russia through the Caucasus to the Georgian border, and he was selling it to someone he believed was Al-Qaeda, but fortunately for the world, was an undercover cop, and so he was busted. But I sat down and got an extraordinary interview with him, and he told me something very chilling. He told me that 9 grams can bring down an elephant. And he was talking about the World Trade Center and the attacks on 9/11. And he was meaning that a small bullet can bring down a big country like an elephant, just as a small amount of this nuclear material, this highly enriched uranium that he was smuggling, could bring down a big country like the U.S. And I sat there, and he told me this in an interview, and it's in the movie, and I was just so frightened that somebody would want to blow up the U.S. with a nuclear bomb and would actually tell me this. And I hadn't realized when I started this movie that all the steps required for a terrorist to blow up a city like New York City, which is a city I called home for very many years, all those steps not only could happen, but they had individually each happened. Now, fortunately, they've never lined up into one sequence that's resulted in a nuclear weapons attack on the U.S. But unfortunately, there's really a real problem here, and the movie really breaks that problem down and shows us that the making of a bomb is actually not that challenging. It's sort of a graduate student-level problem. In fact, there was a famous hearing, Lawrence can tell this story, where then-Senator Biden...
What happened is then-Senator Biden was having a Senate hearing, and he was basically talking about how hard is it to make a bomb. And the people in the Intelligence Committee were trying not to say how easy it was, but it turns out that it's extremely easy. And they actually, we talk about, Graham Allison from Harvard talks about how some of the graduate students actually, they're given this task. And Biden says, I don't believe this, and prove it. And so they literally had some students go make a bomb and bring it into the Senate hearing. Of course, not with the fissile material. And, well, you can imagine that was a jaw-stopping movement, a moment to see that happen.
Yeah,
so
as
Lucy was saying, as you were mentioning, the material that you find on the black market, this is the most harrowing stuff because, you know, let's think about it. If it's not that hard to make a bomb, if a terrorist can acquire a scientist to make a bomb, because, you know, you and I could do it, but a scientist could with what you could find on the Internet, then what we really have to figure out is how to stop them from acquiring the fissile material to stick in that bomb to blow things up.
I don't know what I found more alarming watching some of those interviews that Lucy was just mentioning, the malice of these, you know, basically small-time crooks, or just the sort of banality of the fact that they were hoping to buy kitchen appliances with the money they made, and,
yeah, that's right.
Fancy cars.
That's right. Leonard Smirnov in the movie, who wants to buy a refrigerator, and Oleg Hintsugov, who I sat down with, who likes, yeah, fancy cars. And there's also the frightening thing that Oleg thought that the Taliban was trained in the Scottish Highlands. And you sort of think, well, goodness, you in your mind's eye might picture a nuclear smuggler as more like a James Bond sort of villain. At least they'd have a good working understanding of the world. And this guy actually thought that the Americans trained the Taliban in Scotland. I mean, it's frightening how, ignorant, banal, venal, you know, human beings are very imperfect creatures, I suppose. And that's the problem with these weapons, is they're very, very calamitous. And human beings are frail, and security systems are never fallible. We have an amazing guy, Scott Sagan, who's a professor at Stanford, and he breaks down why you can never get the risks down to zero with these weapons. And that's just really important to remember.
Lawrence Bender, I wanted to ask, you know, this countdown to zero is a heavy topic. It follows an inconvenient truth, another heavy topic. I'm wondering if you can tell me about participant media, which basically developed, financed, and executive produced Countdown to Zero along with World Security Institute. Can you tell me who these two groups are, what their aims are in releasing this film?
We only like to make movies that have calamitous and devastational effects on the world. No, absolutely. Well, actually, the way this movie came about was that after An Inconvenient Truth, two kind of things happened that sort of got the ball rolling on this, is that a lot of people are coming to me and participant media. Participant media financed the movie, and I produced it along with some other people. I'm talking about Inconvenient Truth now. And anyway, Jeff Skoll and I were in Oslo with Al Gore when he was receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. And Jeff Skoll, the financier of An Inconvenient Truth, so we were talking about, first of all, pinching ourselves that we were actually there with Al Gore when he was receiving the Nobel Peace Prize. It's not something that, you know, it's not something that a filmmaker dreams about, you know, Nobel Peace Prizes. It was an extraordinary moment for us. And so we started to talk about, on that very cold day, dark day, what else can affect life on a planetary basis. And, of course, it's the nuclear threat. And right around the same time, I was, you know, getting a lot of incoming phone calls about, well, I'd like to do The Inconvenient Truth of this, and I'd like to do The Inconvenient Truth of that subject. And I got a call from Bruce Blair and Matt Brown from WSI. They started the Global Zero movement, and they said that we'd like to do a documentary about the An Inconvenient Truth of nuclear weapons. And so these three groups, myself, WSI, Bruce Blair, Matt Brown, and Jeff Skoll's company participant, we teamed up to embark on this movie literally 3 years ago. And the intention, of course, is to make a movie that's a wake-up call. Not necessarily to, you know, the truth is scary. So in a sense, to tell the truth, people can understand what's really going on out there, and ultimately, yes, be scared, but ultimately also feel like there's something that we can do. And in the movie, hopefully, is a wake-up call and to help bring this issue up to the top of the political agenda, and to help the politicians kind of push what needs to happen through so that once again we can get on. You know, in the 80s, as Lucy mentioned, that was more of a liberal movement. Now we actually have a really interesting moment in time. 3 years ago,
I'm going to have to ask you, Lawrence, to start running to a close because we're nearing the end of the hour. We're talking with Lawrence. We're talking with, we'll get back to you, Lucy. We're talking with Lawrence Bender, producer, Lucy Walker, director of Countdown to Zero, which is playing in theaters now at the Opera Plaza Cinemas in San Francisco, the Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley. You can join the conversation by calling 866-733-6786 or emailing us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. Stay with us. Good morning. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Welcome back to the second hour of Forum. We're talking about Countdown to Zero, an argument for an end, a control to nuclear proliferation. The film was written and directed by Lucy Walker, also known for Devil's Playground and Blind Sight, and produced by Academy Award winner Lawrence Bender, also known for Inglourious Basterds and An Inconvenient Truth. Thank you so much for continuing to be with us here this morning. I wanted to raise this question, Lucy Walker. Russia's foreign ministry released a report this past Saturday accusing the U.S. of violating dozens of treaties, apparently a tit for the tat of Americans accusing the Russians of doing the same thing. You know, you think about all the issues that have come up since the presumptive end of the Cold War. This doesn't seem to bode well for international cooperation.
I think it's important to remember how frail I think that the peace and stability of the world is. And I think I would love personally to see the START Treaty ratified. That's something that we talk about in the movie a little bit, and it's something that's really on top of the political agenda right now. And the important thing, I think, to remember is that the old START Treaty has expired, and currently there is no inspections regime or transparency sort of in place, and it's really important that we get this treaty ratified and that it doesn't get sort of mired in party political game playing, which in nuclear weapons, again, once you start to remember how urgent and important this threat is, I think that everyone would want to move towards a safer world as soon as possible. Something that I'm very aware of today, I must say, is that it's August 9th, and 65 years ago today was the bombing of Nagasaki. And actually, 65 years ago, last Friday on August 6th, 3 days ago, was the bombing of Hiroshima. Or Hiroshima, that's my British accent for you. And then a couple of weeks ago was actually the first Trinity test as well. So it's really 65 years since these bombs were invented, and it's 65 years since they were last used in a war situation in Nagasaki. And I think about that a lot, and think about how it's been 65 years, and in some ways we can feel quite complacent. Oh, the bomb hasn't been used to attack a city in 65 years. And I think some people can feel like, oh, maybe it'll never happen again because it's been such a long time. But I think when we think about the world in the biggest possible picture, 65 years is not such a long time. And when relations, international relations, can sometimes feel very delicate, even if a bomb doesn't go off again for another 65 years, that will be, you know, way too soon again, because the effects will just be so absolutely horrific.
I want to remind our listeners that they can call in with their questions and comments, 866-733-6786. And, of course, you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Let's go now to Peter in Santa Clara.
Oh, hi. How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. Looking forward to watching this movie, by the way. And I did notice the anniversary as well. I'd like to comment that I really don't think zero is a good number. And I wonder if the leaders that the filmmakers interviewed actually believe that, or if they say that they believe that zero isn't a good number just because it's good PR for them. And I say that knowing how, well, as well as anybody can, knowing how absolutely horrific these devices are. And just for reference, I did work briefly at Los Alamos, and some of my friends are still there doing design work such as there is these days. And, they're good people. They honestly believe that these devices are absolutely horrific, but that they help maintain some stability. And, I don't know that this is true, but the argument has been made, I believe, that the Cold War could have been a hot war but for these devices. And nowadays, we don't worry about state actors as much as we worry about terrorists, and they can't go after them. If they nuke you, you can't nuke them back, so there's no deterrence there. But there still are state actors like North Korea.
It's a good question. Let's put it to...
I'd have to respond to that.
Lawrence Bender.
Thank you. And thanks for that question, because that's a question that does come up. And it's so the Cold War, and thank God it was not a hot war. And there are people who believe that the mutually assured destruction idea worked, and maybe it did. But things have changed quite a bit since then. And we don't need nuclear weapons necessarily. For instance, can you imagine France attacking Germany today? Or it's a world in which globalization, we're very interdependent, right, in so many different ways. So there are not so many people who believe that nuclear weapons are necessarily needed to sort of prevent one country from attacking another. But let me just go back to one thing, which I was going to actually say earlier, is that this started in 2007 with four very conservative gentlemen. They call themselves the four statesmen, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Sam Nunn, and Bill Perry, two Republicans, two Democrats, obviously not liberals, wrote an op-ed article basically saying post-Cold War and post-9/11, we need to look at the way, we need to change the way we look at nuclear weapons. And they put at the top of this kind of metaphorical mountain the idea of zero nuclear weapons. And if you go back even further, this is a dream of Ronald Reagan's. So it is, this is an idea that is, people are changing the way now that they look at nuclear weapons. And we can get into a very vigorous debate about this. I'm not sure you want to spend the entire time on the phone, on the radio talking about this, but I'm happy to do it. There are many things. I'll give you one example. Some people talk about the nuclear umbrella. And a country like Japan, for instance, talks about, some people say, well, Japan would be worried if the United States gave up its nuclear weapons because they wouldn't have a nuclear umbrella of protection, for instance. But the Japanese ministers say that that's actually not true, and we actually would like to see a world without nuclear weapons. Then I'll just say very briefly, we had this conference in Paris, had a lot of people from Pakistan and India there, and many others around the world, generals, heads of the military, heads of the Air Force, people whose fingers were on the button, who were in charge of nuclear weapons, who said very strongly that 10, 15 years ago, they believed very strongly that it was in their national security interest to have nuclear weapons. Now they believe very strongly that it is in their national security interest for the world to go to zero.
Yeah, I think it's interesting your question with the question of PR, because I feel like actually a lot of the people who speak out for zero get a lot of criticism about being idealistic or naive, and it's actually a pretty brave position to take, and I certainly don't think they're doing it for good PR, because if anything, they're open to a lot of attack. And if anything, the people in the movie could easily have said no. Nobody was compelled to agree to be in this movie. Everyone who agreed to be in this movie did so because they were willing to risk even being associated with these horrible weapons by mentioning them, by being in the movie, in order to speak out about how urgently they felt that they threatened our very existence as a species. They can't be underestimated in their consequence, these weapons. Einstein, who, by the way, called nuclear weapons his one mistake, said something that sticks with me. He said, nuclear weapons have changed everything except for our way of thinking, and thus drift we towards unparalleled catastrophe. This idea that we now have the means to destroy our species and our planet, and that this could really be quite easily achieved, that the movie looks at these jaw-dropping examples, that even a lieutenant during the Cold War, there were no security measures that could prevent a single lieutenant doing what we saw in that movie, Dr. Strangelove. General Jack D. Ripper wanted to just set off World War III, and we show in the movie that people could have done that. I look in, you know, for example, at Pakistan, if you want to start worrying about things, let's just look at Pakistan for a little moment and imagine that maybe in future there'll be lots of countries a little bit like Pakistan. They're going to have nuclear arsenals. Pakistan, for example, it's in a hot war with India, with which it shares a border. There's not even any sort of thinking time. If there was an attack between the countries, response times would be absolutely, split second. It's an unstable country with an unstable government with a lot of insurgents. It's the world headquarters of Al-Qaeda. You've got a divided military. You could have a colonel's coup. You've got extremist elements both in the military and the nuclear weapons establishment, which does actually recruit on a sort of Islamic sort of pride, sort of ticket to some extent. And there's just a whole world of things that could go wrong. And if even one nuclear weapon was to get into the wrong hands, how comfortable would you be living in a major U.S. city, as I, for example, now do? Now, if I was aware that that one single nuclear weapon was in the wrong hands, I would really be rethinking my decision to live where I do in Los Angeles.
Making a point to switch to a rural life. I want to thank Peter for his question and move the conversation along, because of what the issues you've raised are so alarming, to Diana's question from Palo Alto.
Good morning. Yes, I saw the movie with a couple of nuclear activist friends, and we kind of felt that the style of the movie was a bit dated because it mostly dealt with the fearful prospects of the present situation. And we had hoped that it might contain some methods or strategies so that we could move forward. And the problem that we saw was that what the world seems to need is security. I mean, it's fear that makes all of these countries want to have nuclear weapons. And that if they could be guaranteed some kind of security, like perhaps by a world government or by a world united and saying that war is no longer an acceptable solution, and anyone that starts a war will have to face the consequences of some kind of,
Diana raises a good point. Lucy, I have to admit, I wondered, you know, much of the film is taken up with sort of making the case that nuclear weapons are dangerous for all sorts of reasons. Mm-hmm. And then at the very end of the film, we get almost sort of the equivalent of a music video as various solutions fly by on the screen.
Could I answer that for a second? Because
yeah.
It's a little bit like An Inconvenient Truth, in a sense. And actually, we got a little bit of the same criticism with An Inconvenient Truth, too. So let me just talk for a second, Lucy, if you don't mind, a little bit about that, because there's a little similarity there. And I appreciate the fact that what you mentioned is like, okay, are we trying to scare people?
So much that, but given that it is such a serious issue, and many people will respond by saying, well, what can we do about it?
Exactly.
What can we do about it?
Here's the thing is that
what we really try to do is to
really make people, see, the thing is, the woman who just spoke, I forgot what her name is, but, you know, she mentioned that she went with a couple of nuclear activist friends, and so we didn't actually make the movie for them because they actually know about this issue quite a bit, the nuclear activists. But the problem is there are very few nuclear activist people in the country. And so I applaud the nuclear activists because, you know, we need more of them. But what the actual movie was intended to do was to reach out to the people who are not thinking about this issue at all. And 99.9% of the people who are listening to this probably have not thought about a nuclear weapon in quite some time, because it's just not in your life. And so we made the primary focus of the movie was to show the problems, the issues that are going on right now today, and it is scary and it is real. And like An Inconvenient Truth, we took a very small time at the end of the movie to say, here's some things you can do, there is hope. But the biggest chunk of the movie was to say, here is the problem and here's why we need to be thinking about this. And then, of course, we talk about what you can do at the very end, and there's things that one can do. And then, of course, we send you to a website, takepart.com/zero, where you can then find out all the different things that is going on with the movement. And that's kind of how we structure the movie.
Lucy Walker, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'll just say it's a great point, and I am so inspired and humbled by the nuclear weapons activists. They were so important in making the movie, and I hope there'll be more movies on the topic moving forward. And I hope that the momentum behind the movement for zero and the excitement that people feel as they look at President Obama calling for a world without nuclear weapons in Prague, as he did last year, and doing all these wonderful things that he's doing. I mean, now is a great time to feel optimistic, actually, and it's a great time for nuclear weapons activists who maybe felt a little disconnected from the issue in the intervening years to sort of reconnect with their passion for a secure world. And we hope that this movie is going to be a step towards that and not the only step.
You know, one of the compelling solutions offered up at the end of the film is the idea of a sort of international Fort Knox to collect and safeguard fissible material. Is there any serious movement towards making something like that happen?
Absolutely. Something that's been talked about quite a bit, and having different countries. There's different parts of the world where that's actually happening now, where you have several countries controlling the material, you just brought up, actually you didn't bring it up, I was just reading it, sorry, but it just came up, so Vietnam, we're having this negotiation with Vietnam. Vietnam wants to have nuclear power plants, right? And now the UAE, we made this gold standard deal with the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, where they're going to have nuclear power plants. We're going to bring them the material, the uranium. They're going to use it, and then we're going to take it back, and so that there's never going to be this issue of them having to create the enrichment process that ultimately leads to what happens is you enrich the uranium for a power plant, for an energy plant, but if you keep enriching it, it can become weapon-grade material. So that's what's happening in Iran right now. That's our fear about Iran. With the UAE, they said, no, we don't want to even come close to having that situation happening. We're happy for you. We're happy just to have the energy. You bring us the material. And so there's all kinds of things like that going on in the world right now that that people are working on, and I think that's great.
Well, with that, I'd like to take us next to Neil in San Francisco.
Hello.
Yes, Neil.
Yeah, well, first of all, I would like to know if it's so easy to make a nuclear weapon, as your speakers have suggested, why is it that Iran is having such a hard time completing one? They've been going on for years, and I believe it's they're building centrifuges and so on. But it's not easy to do.
Luxie Walker, do you want to take Neil's question?
Yeah, absolutely. We have in the movie a guy called Scott Kemp, who's a physicist at Princeton. He's actually now with the government, but he's done some remarkable work on this area of the gas centrifuge enrichment of uranium. I tell you why this is really, really important, because plutonium, the bombs you make from plutonium are actually much harder to make, and that's a slightly more difficult route. The bombs you can make from highly enriched uranium are so easy to make that the graduate students, they're the bombs we were talking about earlier, the graduate students can make them. When it was used in Hiroshima, 65 years and 3 days ago, they didn't even test it because they were so confident that this design was easy to be confident that it would actually work. It's really easy to make a device once you get a hold of this material. This material, though, fortunately, is really hard to enrich to the right quantity where it's going to sustain a chain reaction, where it's going to go nuclear and destroy a whole city. It's a very common element in nature, uranium. It's more common than tin, but it's been tricky to extract or get it to sufficient enrichment level of the radioactive isotope that you need in order to have this chain reaction. Now, unfortunately for us, this centrifuge technology, which was devised in the 1950s, is really becoming better and better understood and better and better used. Now, Iran is not making it look as easy as it maybe is and is going to look increasingly in the future, because they started out with these P2 centrifuges from Pakistan, which was actually sort of a tricky, not particularly state-of-the-art, sort of problematic starting point. Now, they've sort of gone a slow and quite hard route. They've sort of taken the north face, if you like, a slightly circuitous and more challenging route. And as time goes on, you know, we can all just extrapolate from our experience with any technology. You know, unfortunately, as time goes on with any technology, it gets better and better understood. The components get easier and easier to get a hold of, to put together. And we're now in a world where any country that can have a college can enrich uranium. Now, Iran isn't, as I said, making it look as maybe easy as it is. And in future, the footprint of an enrichment facility is actually going to be no easier to detect than, say, a cookie factory or a potato chip factory. So in future, we're in a world where not only countries, but maybe even non-state actors are going to be able to enrich their own uranium. And if they can enrich their own uranium, they can very easily make a uranium-type device. So we're in a world where we need to rethink the way in which we're approaching securing this material. And that includes locking down the material that we've gotten and completely rethinking our regime to discourage proliferation. And so I think you'll see in the movie Scott Kemp, he's just absolutely the world's most foremost expert on this area, and he really explained to us why it is that we're really in such a worrisome position in the world today and why it's really time to rethink these questions. And unfortunately, Iran is something of a tipping point, and in future it's going to look a lot easier and countries are going to get there a lot faster.
Neil, does that answer your question?
Yes, very well. But I would like to also point out that if fanatical religious fundamentalist types who would like to commit some kind of nuclear religious suicide get their hands on, then normal forms of deterrence would be kind of useless.
That's right.
And one other point, if we were to eliminate nuclear weapons altogether in the world, I believe that there is a danger of going back to a World War One or World War Two type scenario, because you said, well, France will never attack Germany and so on. Right. But I don't think Russia and China, among big powers, are entirely integrated into the world system yet. And so there is a danger of a conventional, enormous world war without atom bombs, possibly. That's my final point.
Thank you, Neil. Megan from San Francisco asked this question. If the U.S. were to be the first to abolish our nuclear weapons program, if we were to take that first step, do you think there would be a positive or negative response? Would it make our country more unsafe? Let me put this to Lawrence Bender.
I would never advocate that. I don't think anyone in the global zero movement would ever advocate that. I think we would make us much less safe. And to the former person that was just on the phone, point,
Neil, yeah,
would put us in some danger there, because right now we do have nuclear weapons. Lots of other countries have nuclear weapons, so we would not want to get rid of ours before someone else got rid of theirs. That would be, I think, that would be a big mistake. I think the thing that we would want to advocate, though, is a slow, steady reduction where America and Russia do take the lead to reduce and to put a downward pressure on other countries like China and so forth to reduce. And as we reduce, and this over a period of time, that there would be a downward pressure, a downward cycle, a less tolerance for other countries, because as we get less and less, there's going to be less tolerance for other countries to get them, like Iran or outliers like North Korea. And those tolerance levels would go further and further. There'd be less and less tolerance for that. And in the meantime, I think it's very important to understand that, okay, does that create more stability or less stability in the world? I think that's a very important point. And I think we do believe now that, and many people believe, again, this is not just myself, but many people have changed in the way they think about these weapons, that the world would become actually more stable, because as Lucy has said several times now, a nuclear weapon, the chance of that happening, if it happens, is such a monumental event that would really change the world. And we're kind of at a place now where we have a choice. Either lots more countries have them or no countries have them. For instance, there are 40 countries right now today, if they said we want a nuclear weapon, within 1 year could have the weapon. They're choosing not to. And I think that's a very important point, that as long as we're taking a direction of, okay, slowly but surely we're going to decrease our weapons to none, then these other countries will say, okay, well, we're not going to get them.
Peter has a very interesting point. He's emailed into forum@kqed.org. He says one of the great errors of the Iraq War was the conflation of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons as quote-unquote weapons of mass destruction. Peter says putting these weapons on equal footing is absurd. There are nukes, and then there is everything else. And this raises an interesting question, you know, that perhaps speaks to some of the complacency, Lawrence Bender, you were talking about earlier, that we are not thinking about the fulsome threat that nuclear weapons represent.
I think that's right.
Lucy.
I think, well, something that's interesting when I think about the Iraq War and the WMD history, our recent history, was we heard this phrase, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud, and everyone got very scared, and it turned out that that particular fear was groundless. And so it's important, in making this movie, we felt, to really get into the actuality of the threat and not just make any sort of hollow, fear-mongering noises about Al-Qaeda, and actually just to sort of ask a sincere and innocent question. Has anything actually happened with terrorism and nuclear weapons? Is there actually a risk? And what is the difference between nuclear, chemical, and biological, and what sort of threat do they pose, and what are the different stories? And what we, in fact, found was that there was a lot to worry about, and the CIA conflates WMD, and Rolf Moert-Larsen, who's in the movie, was in charge of WMD for the CIA, and he really puts the intelligence in intelligence and has seen more classified information than maybe anyone else on this issue. And he said that the thing that scared him the most was that he became aware after 9/11 that terrorists were trying to get their hands on nuclear weapons, that there had been actual steps, actual meetings with nuclear scientists and al-Qaeda, actual shopping lists, actual attempts at Japanese
terror cult, more,
as well as al-Qaeda.
Lucy, what scares you most? Terrorism, a government, or just the possibility of an accident?
They all scare me. The risk on all of these aspects is not zero. And as time goes on, something is going to happen that just statistically, if the risk isn't zero, as we move forward through time, and Lawrence is exactly right, we're looking at a world in future where many, many countries and also non-state actors, that's terrorists, are going to be able to get them unless we rethink everything and get everyone
right, which is the
together.
And Lawrence, I'm gonna have to let Lucy go out on that note. I want to thank you both, Lawrence Bender, producer of Countdown to Zero, and Lucy Walker, writer and director of Countdown to Zero, which is in theaters now at the Opera Plaza Cinemas in San Francisco and the Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Rachel Myro. I'm filling in for Michael Krasny. And your comments are welcome at kqed.org/forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.